come.
Sorry?
He can't come.
Xiaoji can't come either, so we're going the four of us. What I wanted to do was cover a number of smaller things, and not only one of them is going off the topic of morphometrics. But the first thing I think I should say is that you will be asked to do an evaluation on the course. I think I've been having mysterious communications with the Department of Biology, the person who's in charge of that. And I get the impression that the way they do it these days is you get an email that says you're to go online and do an evaluation. Is that how it works? There was some confusion over what deadline dates we wanted to set for the evaluation, which didn't make any sense to me, because Fred and I don't care when the evaluations are done. The evaluations I've used all of my career are paper ones, but now this is online, which will make it to some extent incomparable. But the thing I mostly wanted to say to you is that Fred is retired, and I am about to retire, so the evaluations don't actually, we aren't helped or hurt by them particularly, except insofar as they give us good information about the course. But neither of us is coming up for promotion, neither of us is being evaluated for a salary increase or anything like that. So I just hope everybody will do it, and you'll give us honest feedback about all respects of the course. We're not sure that a course like this will be taught again, because we're both retiring, and it's not high on the department's radar screen. We volunteered it. We weren't asked to do it. So that's that issue. The other thing I thought I would do is to go back to the migration issue that I was talking about last time, when I couldn't find the software to run to show you how this bias arises. And I finally found an almost complete version of the R routine and fixed it up so it is complete. And so I just thought I'd do a few runs. And then I want to talk to you a little bit about the morphometric consensus, and talk to you a little bit about within species, within population variability, and how you incorporate it into some of these analyses. So it's kind of today will be kind of helter-skelter. And at the end, if there are like particular questions, we will probably have time for those. So let me just show you that migration case, which I showed you some of this before. Just a moment here. Yeah, here is tiny little bot. I see what's going wrong here. I'm going to make it bigger. And it has the usual problem on my computer of the axis numbers being far too small for some unknown reason. Let me just try to plot a different plot. There we go. I don't know if that's... This looks very faint. Is this visible? So this was a case with 100 populations. There is a slope of optimum. When you simulate optimum selection and genetic drift in each population, they're wandering around the optimum. Migration correlates those. And we got plots that look like this, and you can see that the residuals are correlated with each other. There is that actually, in this numerical example, they're fairly fairly correlated. I wish I knew how to make those numbers bigger. Okay, so this is the kind of data that you're dealing with. And if we do other runs with the same parameters, the parameters here are population size of 100, migration rate of 0.005, that's 0.5% per generation, and the strength of return to the optimum is 0.2% of the way each generation, and then the slope of the optima is 0.1. If I do that a second time, you'll see similar results, and again, still correlations. And I can imagine doing many, many such runs. But what I now have is a program. Let's see. The question is, if I have, let's do a run with zero slope of the optimum. So of this one, the optimum is the same in every population, but we don't know that. We look at the data, we see it fluctuating. There are correlated deviations, correlated residuals. And if somebody were to do an ordinary regression on those points, ignoring the fact that the residuals are correlated, they would get a slope that isn't quite zero, but it would have a confidence interval on it. When you did the ordinary confidence interval on a slope calculation, that would, we hope, include zero. Okay. So now the question is, if you have this case where there is zero slope in reality, how often will you get a false signal that there is positive slope? And that's where this program comes in, because what I'm going to do, regress M, okay, it has the same parameters, so I'm going to give it exactly the same values. So it actually has zero slope, but what it's going to do is it will do the equivalent of 100 runs of this simulation program. For each of them, it will also do the regression and calculate a confidence interval. And it'll show you the confidence intervals for all 100 runs. There's 100 replicates here. So here we go. And I don't know, you know, but I guess if we look hard enough, we can see this. So what we've got here is the actual true optimum, zero, the true slope, which is zero. So the vertical axis here now is not phenotype, or mean phenotype, is slope. And for one of these runs, like this very first one, there is the confidence interval on slope, and it does include the truth. Okay. And if you go along, you'll see that some of the confidence intervals include the truth and some don't. And what I did was to write this program so that when a confidence interval did not include zero, it made it red and a little thicker, so easier to see.
So yeah. The type 1 error rate here is more like 20% instead of the 5% that it should be.
Let's find out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. So out of 100 inferences of the slope, 21 of them exclude zero. 21 of the percent of the time, you will rush off and write a paper saying, I found evidence that this optimum is different in different populations. Isn't it wonderful? I'm publishing a paper. So there are 21 papers, so to speak, that are going to be published with false signal in them. And the reason for the false signal is that the residual in each of these analyses, the residuals aren't independent. So let me, and if I were to do it with a, let's see if I get this right, no migration, then the residuals are independent. So now I'm going to do a run with no migration, so adjacent populations are independently drifting. And here come
here are the runs. They're almost there. And what we have is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So the number of cases where you reject the true zero slope is 9 out of 100. It should be 5 out of 100.
Well, let me do a couple more runs to see if we can come closer to expectation. That was 9.
Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4. And that's it. So that one had 4. If we do another run, so this is under a case where it should work. Statistics should work. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So far, it's being a little high. Here comes another one. 1, 2. Okay, so those where we have 23, see if I added those correctly, yes, 23 where we expect 20. It's not bad. So, yeah, not too bad. I mean, we hope that if we keep running and running and running, this number will converge on 5%. So, but as soon as you put in, let's put in a little more migration. I'll put in more than we had before. I'll put in 0.01, twice as much migration. Now, with the migration, oh, it's pretty bloody.
Ouch.
Ouch, yes. This is 1% migration. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41. Nearly half of your runs, you would get a false signal. And you get a false signal because you think that this regression has 100 independent points. In effect, it has fewer than 100 independent points because adjacent points are correlated in their residuals. So that's just making the point I made last time, which is then you have to do something else, and there are these ways, including doing a scheme of contrasts among populations that will escape from this problem. Not one that's widely available, though. In fact, not much available at all. So I just wanted to show you that. That was the missing computer example. And the rest of what I wanted to do is to talk about two, I think I can turn off the projector for the moment and use the board. If I can figure out.
Yeah.
So, I guess the two things that I wanted to cover, one was the issue of the morphometric consensus, and the other was this issue of within species variation. So, looking out at the sea of faces here, I guess the first thing I want to ask is, do you guys know about the morphometric consensus? Okay. It's the biggest deal in morphometrics, and Fred hasn't talked about it, and I haven't talked about it. I think I may have mentioned it once earlier on. And I want to tell you about it so that you'll know what it is if you run into it, because neither Fred nor I are much in favor of doing it anymore. In fact, we're both setting out to criticize it, but you know, if you go out there and say, oh, I was trained in morphometrics, and somebody starts talking about the morphometric consensus and their methods, you might be mystified, and then they'll say, why, you don't know about morphometrics at all. You don't know the most important single piece of machinery in morphometrics, the morphometric consensus. And in fact, you will be right and they will be wrong. That is, as far as it's both Fred and my position that the morphometric consensus is kind of a waste of time. Now, it's a little weird because Fred is one of the inventors of the morphometric consensus, although David Kendall, the late David Kendall, who was a famous probabilist and who did some important work on morphometrics around the late 80s, they are people who originated the morphometric consensus, and Fred has come to see that maybe it's not such a good idea. So let me try to, okay, morphometric consensus. I don't have a projection on it, but I'm going to kind of try to explain what it is and then explain why it's got some issues. Okay, so the first thing is you will be extensively familiar with getting landmarks, okay, that's not a big, and then semi-landmarks too, but I'm not going to talk about them. And then superposing your specimens by doing a generalized Procrustes analysis. Okay, so far so good. So GPA. I think it's fair to say that all of you, is it fair to say that all of you in your projects have done a generalized Procrustes analysis at some point? I don't know. Yours is morphometrics, but it's not geometric morphometrics, so yours wouldn't have. But the other three, you've all done, you've not only done Procrustes superpositions between forms two at a time, but a multiple, but an overall joint superposition of everything. Okay, so far so good. Here's where it starts to go off track. Get Procrustes distances. Where you, between pairs of specimens, so Dij is the Procrustes distance between specimens I and J. So you now have a matrix of Procrustes distances. Okay. So now what the morphometric consensus of that was approximately completed in 1991, and it was sort of formally declared to the world in 1996 in a volume, so 20 years ago. Then do principal coordinates analysis. This is where I think I'm going to have to question you again, because of the distances. So in your morphometric work, is that what you're doing? Or are you doing something else? And what we have to do is make clear what the distinction is.
This is a principal coordinates on the distances, not on the actual points.
On the distances. It should be done in some of the software that you have access to. It's options in there. What's the alternative? The alternative is to take the superpositions. So I'll say instead of doing principal coordinates, there's a, I'm sorry, yeah, principal components, I'm sorry, principal.
So that's done on the
components analysis on the landmark, the superposed landmarks. Let me just think for a second. So, is it fair to say that what a lot of you have done is this ladder, right? So you're using the coordinates, and that you get everything superposed, you use the coordinates, and then you're doing things like principal components or, in some cases, canonical variants. But what the morphometric consensus does is to take the distances and do a thing called principal coordinates, which I believe Fred mentioned when he talked about John Gower, that John Gower had invented it in the 1960s. And it's basically a principal components analysis that you can do on distances. And to indicate how it works, there's a whole series of operations. They include averaging distances in rows and columns and subtracting them out from the distances and then doing a principal components. After you do a bit of that stuff, you do a principal components on the resulting matrix. But what it's equivalent to doing is the following. If I have a bunch of points, let's see if I get this right. When we have the superpositions, each of the specimens is a multivariate entity. It's got, if there are two dimensions and P landmarks, there's two P coordinates. So you can imagine it as a point in 2P space, 2P dimensional space. Each of your specimens is a point in that space. Now, if you take the Procrustes distances between two specimens, those will be, let's see.
Joe, I
think I may be about to misinform you, but
are they the same? Don't they result in the same thing? I thought that's what Fred said something about that resulting in something similar.
Yeah, they are.
Well, I think that was about principal coordinates and principal components on the same data set, but this is principal coordinates on something different than you'd be doing.
I guess the part where I am a little fuzzy on the morphometric consensus is, you could do pairwise superpositions between points in which a pair of specimens are rotated translated and expanded or shrunk to get a Procrustes distance between that pair. And you could do a similar thing pairwise for every pair. And that would be a set of Procrustes distances, but the Procrustes distances are, I think the Procrustes distances in the morphometric consensus are not that, but they're doing a generalized superposition and then doing the pairwise distances. And yes, Fred is right that this, that if you do this principal coordinates thing, in effect what it does is it takes the distance matrix, which is all the distances among these points. I'm trying to draw all of them. No, I duplicated effort there. There's one. Nope, I had that. Anyway, get all the distances. And in effect, what the morphometric consensus is doing is taking those distances and saying, well, let's just use the distances. Now, if you use the distances, you can do triangulation. You could imagine doing triangulation to set up a set of points that have those distances. So the way you do that, of course, I mean, it's kind of straightforward triangulation. So if you start with, if this is point one, and this is point two, and this is point three, you have a distance between point one and two, so you maybe put point one here at the origin, and you put point two out on the first axis at the appropriate distance. Then for point three, what we do is we say, well, we know what its distance from point one is, and we know what its distance from point two is, and what that does is find us two points that satisfy those distances, and we can pick one. So we can then put it at a point that will then have the correct distances. And we keep going. And if you keep going, you can imagine doing that in our matrix operations that will do that. And basically, it will get you a bunch of points that are these points, but perhaps rotated and shifted about and located somewhere convenient. But they still have... they're still relative to each other. They're still the same cloud of points.
So it's sort of a dimensional reduction?
It's not reducing dimension at all. Because the next one, when I get
point
four...
Oh, because those points are already distances. They're not the actual...
You are given only the distances. Okay. You're given only the distances. So you say, well, if I have these distances and nobody's bothered to tell me what the points are, then... can I come up with a set of points that has these distances? And the answer is you can by triangulation. The catch is, this up here was in 2P dimensional space. I'm showing you only a two-dimensional space. When you get to point four, you're going to have to come out into a third dimension. Because now what you'll do is you'll basically make spheres around each of those points that are the right, the correct distances, and then there will be one, there'll be a couple of points, maybe one in front of the... one in front of the board and one behind the board that satisfy those distances. So now you'll put four down. Now I'm showing it as if it's in two dimensions, but it's really out in three. So as you go on, you get more and more dimensions. And so you end up with a cloud of points that's exactly the same shape cloud of points, but it's located differently. It's shifted to some other place. Maybe we located one point at the origin. And it's rotated, but in other respects, it's the same bunch of points. So now, if you go and you do principle, if you could imagine doing principle components on those new points, on those relocated points, and I guess what I'm asking you to believe if I have here. Let's imagine this room is a three-dimensional space. And somebody gives me a bunch of points, and they're located in a kind of... here's the origin over here in the corner. Okay. And so our three axes are one going across, one going back, and one going up. And let's now imagine that we have a cloud of points. I'm trying to make a cloud of points. How do I make a cloud of points? I think I use my coat. We have a cloud of points like this, okay, extending up. It's actually on a diagonal, okay. So it's a sort of watermelon shape, fuzzy cloud of points, okay. Now, if we just left them where they were, and we did a first principal component, it's more or less going to go up the long axis of that cloud of points. And the second principal component, if the cloud of points was not circularly symmetrical, but was varied a little more this way than it did this way, the second principal component would probably go like that. They both pass through the means and they go like that. And the third principal component would be shorter and would go this way. Okay. Now, if you do a Procrusti set of Procrusti's distances among these guys, they're just distances among the points. And so if we then take those and make a principal coordinates analysis, we will in effect be transposing this cloud of points over to maybe sit on top of the origin, or have one point sit on the origin. And it might be oriented in a different direction, but it will still be the same cloud of points. And when you make the axis, the principal component's axis that goes through the center, relative to the cloud of points, it will still be in the same place. So it will still, it'll still be the direction of greatest variation. And so the thing that you said, which is you don't really get a different answer, is correct. I mean, if a first principal component went this way here, it would go, I'm trying to get this right, something like that way there. And you get actually the same principal components, only now they're oriented differently. So you get a set of a correct set of principal components for these things out of this analysis, but you're not any longer in your original 2P dimensional space. You're in a so-called tangent plane of the in high dimension, and you're in this morphometric space. And then all the operations you do, you go through basically the same kinds of operations that you would if you just used the superpositions, the original superpositions. But when you find the first axis and then you say to yourself, okay, where is it on the shape? Where is this axis in terms of changes of shape? You have to go through some extra operations to see where it is on the space, and those operations are available. You could say, well, let's interpret this axis in terms of our original landmarks. So, for example, I was using examples of a two-dimensional fish, and if you had one of my fish, which looks something like that, in the analysis, in this case with the phylogeny, the first principal component was changes that go like that, with a little bits of noisily inferred change elsewhere. And that was, in fact, a correct recovery of one of the major shape changes that I built into those data. But in order to get that, you have to kind of do operations to come back from the morphometric space and map things onto the original forms. Okay. So the morphometric space gets you the same answer. But by going off into this weird morphometric space and then later having to come back. And people in morphometrics are very convinced that it is necessary to do this. And I think what Fred and I have come to the conclusion that that most of that is unnecessary. That basically you can go straight from the superposition to doing your to leave your points in basically, except for the operations of the superposition, which slide them around and rotate them and change, and they may or may not change their size depending on what you want to do. Aside from that, you can stay with the original coordinates and do all of your analysis, and that's what you folks are doing. But if you go out and talk to people doing morphometrics, they will say, oh, no, you've got to do the morphometric consensus. So the first thing we come to the conclusion of is it's unnecessary. But the second thing that we come to conclusion is that this is stuff we haven't much talked to you about. We've said it's okay to go ahead with the generalized Procrustes analysis. But in fact, because of Pinocchio effects, because some points, the Procrustes fit makes an assumption. If you justify it statistically, it makes an assumption. And the assumption it makes is that the noise for a landmark is circular, circular independent normal variation.
Okay.
Why then make that assumption? Well, if somebody is digitizing forms, and if we make a simple model of the error that they're making, one naive model would be to say that they have equal error in the x and y directions and they're independent. So they're making a they're digitizing at a point that isn't quite the right point, but is circular. It's circular multivariate normal, not in the sense of that it lives on a circle, but in the sense that it's symmetrical horizontally and vertically, circularly symmetrical. And you can make the assumption that the error made when you digitize the next point is independent of that. So the person, so you're sort of imagining a naive model of error in which each point is getting independent and equal independent deviations of equal error in the x and y directions. And those are all independent from each other. And that's an okay first cut model of digitizing error. Okay. But when we have things like these fishes and they're changing on a tree, the differences between specimens are not just caused by digitizing error. They're caused by biological changes in evolution evolving along the tree. And those changes, in turn, are due to genetic drift and natural selection and migration and all the other evolutionary forces. So it is quite possible that the error isn't like this, and it includes, for example, components that can be correlated with each other so that we have unequal variances at different points, and they're correlated, and the correlations reflect covarying change as you move along the tree. And those covariances, I've been harping on the fact that the covariances come in turn from genetic covariance and selective covariance, plus a little bit of digitizing error. Okay. So the result is the statistical, if you have, let me rewind, if you were in this digitizing error model, what David Kendall showed in 1990, in the late 1980s, I think it was 1986, what David Kendall showed was that doing the Procrustes distances and going off into this morphometric space preserved the circularity of the errors, and you still got points that had the same amount of error in the morphometric space. And by the way, when they go into the morphometric space, another thing people do is very frequently to drop a lot, some of the higher principal components and sort of map everything down to principal components 1, 2, 3, etc. But what he showed was that that this was okay, that with the circular noise the circular noise model of error, everything, the circularity of it, if the error was smallish, the circularity of it and the independence of it was preserved going into the morphometric space. So into shape space, basically. But that's fine. But when you get into the more realistic case of evolutionary change, also for that matter of changes along in growth of individuals, changes between individuals between populations. In all of those, the errors are not going to have this property of being independent and circular. And so you're going to have some points that are moving, changing a great, they're changing in correlated ways, and they're changing a great deal more than other points. Now, if somebody says, okay, is Procrustes fitting the best thing to do? And I think what you can see here is, if you had something where, say, these fins are going crazy and are changing a lot, and everything else is staying is making small movements, that the correct superposition is to not pay too much attention to the fins, but spend your time, have a Procrustes-like machinery that doesn't weight everything equally, that when it sees a lot of variation in the fins, it de-weights that, and it tries harder to fit the other landmarks. So that would be an alternative to a Procrustes superposition. And so what Fred and I are trying to do is say, you know, there are other ways of doing superposition in an analysis, and we're trying to do it in a way that is integrated with a phylogenetic analysis. But the same issues arise at the other levels. So basically what we're saying is not only is, if the error were circular and normal, then it doesn't matter whether you use the Procrustes superposition coordinates or go into the morphometric space. If the errors are correlated and heterogeneous, then it's not established that the pairwise Procrustes distance are the right thing to do. You're much better off. You are better off basically not going to morphometric space, and in fact, you'd be even better off if you could have a superposition method that wasn't Procrustes, but was more robust to Pinocchio effects. So I guess what I'm really trying to say is there's this whole machinery that involves detouring off into shape space, and it's a big thing, it's a central thing in morphometrics, and both Fred and I have become dissenters from that, even though Fred was one of the inventors of it, and one of the chief advocates for it for many years. We are both convinced now that staying in your original space, except for some superpositions, and maybe not even doing the superposition by Procrustes. You know, all the ones you've done are Procrustes because we don't have the other machinery available, basically. But there will ultimately be other machinery available. In the analyses that I'm doing, there's this endless paper that never gets written, but we are writing it on this stuff. And in that paper, I don't use Procrustes analysis. Procrustes for the superpositions. I choose the location. Well, the locations, you do the same thing. You locate on the centroid. There's a good rationale for that. The rotations I do by adjusting them until we get the highest statistical likelihood for the whole analysis. So basically, the rotations are integrated into the rest of the analysis, and you choose those rotations so as to maximize the likelihood of the whole result. Now, the results aren't very different from Procrustes. Procrustes, in practice, is probably pretty good. But in theory, it's not. In theory, this ought to be at least a little bit better. I have to say, in the simulations I've been doing, it has been hard for me to find much advantage over what we're doing as compared to Procrustes. They pretty much get the same angles. I've been trying to make examples of bigger and bigger Pinocchio effects to try to get it to do better than Procrustes. It doesn't do. What I hope to be able to show is that it's at least a little bit better. And if it's a little bit better, that may not be a very strong argument for its use, but it is an argument that the intellectual machinery of going off to morphometric space is maybe people should rethink it and not bother to do it, because you can do it. The one thing we can say is that our methods of rotation are at least as good. They're no worse than what Procrustes is doing. I think they're actually, with the right simulation examples, I will be able to show that they're better. But at the moment, the simulations are cooperating with me and are giving me results that are very similar. So you're okay on your projects doing Procrustes, because probably it's getting an almost the same superposition. On the other hand, there's no intellectual requirement that you go off into shape space or that you do things by all this other Procrustes machinery. So I just wanted to make sure people had heard that. Because if you go away from this and run into people and say, I'm doing morphometrics, they may assume that you're going off into shape space, and then you have to do various weird things to get back and summarize what which things are changing. And the result is, but the truth is, you don't have to, and you guys haven't gone off into shape space in your projects. Yeah.
What was the thought process behind detouring off into shape space before coming back? What made it look important?
I think Fred would give you a better answer to that. I believe that I think the short answer is I don't know the history, so I don't really know why people went there, except that I don't really see why it's necessary to go there. Yeah, that's a poor answer, but I Fred would be able to give you more of the thinking. I think that originally it was superposing triangles and things in Kendall's papers. He was superposing triangles, and then he was saying that this shape space contains all the information. It does if the model of, but the theorem showing it assumed this model of error. And that's not paid much attention to by people, but in fact when there are Pinocchio effects, which we expect in co-varying evolving forms, we expect some landmarks to change a lot more than others, and we expect them to change in correlated ways because there's no reason they shouldn't. And only when you're getting your variation from measurement error is only when the noise is coming in purely as measurement error. But if the noise comes in purely as digitizing error, then you're sort of have an uninteresting case because you're basically saying all our forms are the same, except possibly for size. All of our forms are the same, and it almost becomes an uninteresting case. So, okay. So anyway, that was the one point I wanted to make. The other thing I want to do is talk about finish up by talking about the issue of within species variation, just to give you an idea that it is there and ought to be taken into account. And for that, I'm going to draw a tree. So we're back in phylogenies. Now this point is not specific, this particular point that I'm going to talk about now is not specific to morphometrics. It's for any multivariate data. How it was noticed was this, that Robert Rickleff's famous ecologist, famous evolutionary ecologist, and co-author John Stark, I think it was, Stark, like that, in 1996, and I think it was in Journal of Evolutionary Biology, but I'm trying to remember where it was, they noticed the following. They had a tree. They were doing comparative methods, phylogenetic comparative methods, and they were making contrasts, and they were plotting, you know, they were doing one character versus another, so let's imagine it's brain weight versus body weight. And so what were the contrasts? Well, of course, there's a contrast here, and if these are V1 and V2 in branch lengths, and that's X1 and X2, then the contrast is that it's the difference between these scaled by the standard deviation you would predict from the variance of this is supposed to be V1 plus V2. So if you divide by its standard deviation, let's say the mean X1 minus X2, the expectation in advance is zero, okay? And the standard deviation is square root of V1 plus V2, okay? if you do, compare that to this contrast here, let's call it X3 and X4, then of course you have the same thing, X3 minus X4 over square root of V3 plus V4. And of course, further down in the tree, there's all this algorithmic machinery of constructing a new node here and a new node there and taking contrast between them and adjusting the branch lengths. There's all the machinery that I mentioned to you, which doesn't matter for the point I'm trying to make here. If you compare these, what they found was they were plotting points, you know, looking at regression of brain weight on body weight, or, you know, it was whatever the characters were. They noticed that there were some outliers. And they noticed, let me make it a little more restrained here, that there were some points sitting out way out there. And then they looked on their tree, and they saw that where those points were on the tree is they were pairs of species, they were contrasts coming from pairs of species that were very close to each other. Okay. So you had two close relatives, and they had created this giant contrast. And how had they created it? Well, they came up with an explanation, which I think is the correct one. That caused some people to get a little upset and try to correct for this problem. Okay. So basically they're saying, suppose that it's true, in the phylogenetic comparative method machinery, we assume that the data that you're collecting at the tip is the true mean of the phenotype of the character in that population, in that species. Okay. It's the true species mean. They pointed out, very sensibly, that actually each of these points was an average from some modest number of specimens. So they don't have, you don't have the true means of the species. You just have, like, if they're working with birds, you have three bird skins here and two bird skins there. And you take the averages of your characters, which might be morphometric coordinates, or there may be something else. And the average you're computing for the species has some error due to the finite sample size. So the issue that this thing occurs because there is finite sample size in compute, and you're not computing the true means. And the finite sample size has an effect because there's within species phenotypic variation, which is not exactly a revelation. I mean, we all know that species individuals vary phenotypically within species. And then there's a finite sample size. The result is you don't get this. And why are we seeing a big effect of this? Now, here's where I'm asking you to do some thinking on this. Why are the closely related species the ones that are causing trouble here? I mean, if you have, you might think, well, this could be true at any contrast we make. That is, the means we measure are not the exact true means, but they vary around it a bit. Why on this diagram are the pairs of species that are very closely related and are connected by very short branches? Why are they showing up in the wrong place? If they were showing up in the wrong place. I was hoping it would become immediately apparent. Okay. Well, take a try.
So, if you have your sampling error, which leads to some erroneously extra large difference between x1 and x2, which yeah. gets upweighted by the fact that you're taking the square root of the sum of two very, very small things, which are those small branch things.
Okay, and bingo, that's it. That you're dividing by a small number here. Okay, these differences up here are, have a little plus or minus. There's some error in each of them due to finite sample size. But then you're dividing by this very small thing. You're saying, in effect, that we expect these to differ very little because they're on close. They're close in the tree, and you're blowing up the difference in order to scale everything to get everything to have the same variance. But you're not taking into account that in addition to the variance due to this, the differences between these measurements due to the actual evolution, there's an additional difference due to the finite sample size. And in correcting by dividing by V1 plus V2, you're doing the wrong correction. You're saying these ought to be very close to each other. Actually, they aren't going to be very close to each other, that close to each other, because of the sampling variation and the within species phenotypic variation. For example, suppose these were sitting on the ends of zero length branches. Suppose this branch was tiny. Okay. Well, we still expect sampling variation in each of those means. And most of the difference between them will be due to that sampling variation. So if we make a correction by dividing, by saying, well, it's expected to be very little, let's see how much it is, and scale it against that, then we'll get a completely erroneous result. The result that they found was the small, the closely related pairs were sitting outside of their plot of contrasts, way out there because of the sampling variation. So it was a big problem, potentially big problem. So there's been a couple of papers on this. There was a paper by Ives, Midford, and Garland. Ted Garland, a former postdoc of Ray Huey's, in 2006, and in Evolution. I hope I got the year right. I believe I did. And what they did was to say, well, suppose we knew how the variances and covariances of the within-species phenotypic variation. Suppose we look within species, we see how much things vary and how much they covary owing to just phenotypic variation. So it's just differences between individuals and the population. Then we can take that knowledge of the within species variation and correct the contrast analysis for that by elaborate means, which I'm not going to get into. The second paper, which is obviously the superior paper here, is by me. And it is in American Naturalist in 2008. And basically what I showed was a way of doing something similar to what Ives, Midford, and Garland did, except Ives, Midford, and Garland assumed you somehow knew the within-species variation and covariation exactly. What I did is say, can you estimate the within-species covariation, variation, variances, and phenotypic variances and covariances at the same time that you're doing your contrast analysis? And I showed a way. It's not worth going into all the details, but I basically showed a way of making estimates of not only the evolutionary variances and covariances, which is what you normally do with contrast, but also the phenotypic variances and covariances, which can be different. You could have two characters that within species and within species variation, they're positively correlated. But between species, evolutionary covariation, owing to things like selective covariance, between species, they could be negatively correlated. And this thing would enable you basically to make an estimate of each of those. So you end up with two covariance matrices, one for the within species phenotypic covariance, and the which is something you can pretty well observe almost directly. I mean, you just look at the variation within each species and you pool covariances, and you come pretty close to doing that, to this analysis by doing that. But what I said is you can put the whole thing into one analysis and come out with these two covariances, one the phenotypic covariance within species, and the other is the phylogenetic, the evolutionary covariance of changes between species. So this within species variation is a potentially serious problem when you're doing things like looking at differences between species. It would be an equally serious problem looking at differences between populations within a species. There's no reason that it wouldn't cause similar trouble there. And I think even in looking at growth of individuals and following individuals through time, it might not cause variation there because you know these are the same individuals. So variation from individual to individual would be real there too, and it probably does get taken into account. Except machinery for that I know less about, less what people are doing. But at least at the between population level and the between species level, the fact that you're so-called population means or so-called species means aren't, but they're generally just an average, sometimes of a very modest number of specimens. I mean, you'll have a phylogeny, you'll have a lot of species, some of them are very common and you've got big sample sizes, and others are very rare and hard to get, and there's only, you know, one or two museums that have them, and you just get a few measurements of a few specimens. And then those can lead to contrasts that go way, way wrong. And really, if you want to take it into account, you have to do some sort of analysis, either the Eisenman for Garland or mine, or use, there are computer programs like, there's one called, I think it's called, it's Jared Hadfield's program, MCMC GLIM, which does generalized linear models in using a Bayesian MCMC framework. The models there can be set up so as to include the within-species measurement error, and then an MCMC GLIM analysis will do the right thing, and will make the right inferences for your phylogenetic covariation as opposed to your within-species covariation. All of those will work in some sense, but mostly they're not being used right now. Most comparative analyses that are going on are not taking into account within species sampling error, and that well really ought to. This, of course, is true for morphometrics. It's also true for everything else for which these analyses are being done. Okay. So that was really the other thing I wanted to mention. And so then I'm out of material, but what I think I really want to do is give you a chance, since we've got 12 minutes of class left, and I'm not going to waste it. I'm not going to dismiss you. But maybe if you've encountered other issues or questions in this whole class, now's a good time to bug me about them because it'll help fill class time. So does everybody have a complete understanding of morphometrics? I would say some morphometric methods are still very arbitrary, and some of the arbitrary ones include things like semi-landmarks. Semi-landmarks are placed by a geometric machinery, which is to some extent arbitrary. I mean, mean, I don't think it's obvious that that's the only possible way of placing semi-landmarks. Similarly, the smoothing that's done when you do these grids showing for, I guess, for more than two specimens, how, you know, which parts of the grids are getting squashed in which direction in the kind of partial warps machinery. Or at least the thin plate spline. The thin plate spline plots, they have a little bit of an arbitrary appeal to them too, because you're placing the grid by having a plate that whose bending energy is being minimized, and I'm not really sure what that corresponds to. Now, Fred would, I think, defend it and say that it's the only consistent way of doing things, but it has a little bit of an arbitrary feel to it. Still, these results, you know, probably, these methods probably give you very reasonable results. And I was indicating also that for crusty superpositions, when you have Pinocchio effects, I think they have problems. I don't think they will be the only possible way of superposing specimens. Okay, so.
I have a quick question
about
sample size.
Yeah, you have a way of bringing up very serious questions.
So, in terms of sampling along the phylogeny to account for this interspecific variation, so my question is, like, if you have...
Yeah, please.
So I was wondering, if you take the average, like, let's say this is a phylogeny, right? Would it be better have, like, 100 specimens for this? Or if I have, like, 10 individuals with all sequence, would it be better take 10 individuals to account for this interpopulation variation and have the measures for each tip? Or have 100 or 1,000 individuals and make an average for this whole clade?
That's a very good question. And I would think, I have not thought much about that, but I would think the answer should be that if you're going to use information from things that are closely related and then information from things that are distantly related, if you're going to use those contrasts, you're going to want large sample sizes there, so you can get very accurate accurate species means, basically. It's less important down here that you get an accurate species mean, because the variation is a smaller fraction of the total differences, and it will have a less disaster. It won't move the points as much. Now, there are, of course, other methods than contrasts of analysis of this. There's a thing called the phylogenetic regression, and there's things called Tom Hansen and Amelia Martins thing, which is the generalized least squares approach. But the interesting thing about those is, in the default case, actually, they're all doing the same thing. That whether you do it by contrast or whether you do it by methods that don't use contrast, if you use the same model, you get out the same exact numbers, indicating that what they are different computational... They're different computational machinery for getting exactly the same estimates in the same cases. So if you need large sample sizes in a contrast analysis, you also need them in those other analyses. The other analyses are going to do something equivalent to having a contrast plot. And therefore, no matter which of those machines you're using, if you want to use in cases where there is sampling variation, if you want to use closely related species, then you're best to have large sample size. And there's probably an argument to say, if I only have a modest number of specimens here, maybe I should just have that be, just pick one species and use that and drop the others, because they're likely to bring in too much noise from the within species
sampling variation. So, you know, that's an interesting sort of design issue. Now, I think people usually are stuck with their sample sizes, however. I don't know. I mean, you guys work with actual organisms, so you know. I know you could, you can say, shall I stay at this museum and collect another 10 or another 20 specimens, or should I move on today to the next museum? And that is a genuine optimization question, and issues like this might have some influence in suggesting which of those to do.
Because, for example, for some of the tips of the tree, if you're only using one individual, like molecular data,
right,
if you're measuring like 1,000 specimens, like how good representation is the morphology from all those 1,000, if you're only using one sequence, if you're only sequencing one individual.
Well, okay, this is for the contrast analysis.
Yeah.
For the phylogeny, the issue gets, you keep bringing up these very difficult questions. You know, this one I think it's actually great. Imagine a phylogeny. And here are two species, so there's species one and species two. I think most of you will know about coalescence, and if you pick a locus and you sequence two individuals from this species, and you sequence two individuals from here, at that locus there is a chain of ancestry from individuals to their parents going back in time, and another chain from here, and they come together at random times owing to coalescence of genes in populations. And what that means, if you get if you have species that are closely related, it can lead to discrepancies between the tree of genes and the tree of species. And I suppose in principle what you want to do is use lots of loci and get an accurate measure, an accurate idea what the divergence time of the species was by using methods that take into account the coalescent tree of genes. Those issues become more important as you get to recently diverged things, mostly because if they're distantly diverged, then if I take humans, to be silly, if I take humans and a fish, then I will have a coalescent tree of ancestry of the copies in the humans, and in the fish species I'll have a coalescent tree. But likely that variation will not be very significant compared to the differences between humans and fish. And so if you had simply humans and one fish species and you had no other vertebrates, then having a large sample of humans and a large sample of that fish, of say zebrafish, wouldn't be very important. You know, you'll get a good idea of the divergence without that. But when their species are closely related, you really do want larger molecular samples as well. But not just of individuals, but also of loci. In fact, the loci, the variation from locus to locus is much more important than the variation from individual to individual. I actually have a 2006 paper on that, getting rather obvious answers. But so you're thinking of a case where you only have a single individual for each species. Then you would want to somehow, for the molecular side of the data, you would want to not just use this as the divergence of the two species, but if there was a way, find a way to make some correction for the fact that the species are the divergence of species is not the same as the divergence of the genes. Thinking about it, I think what most people do is ignore that and they go straight ahead. And so
But you could make an equal argument and say that the means differences, the mean differences between these species are affected by this here, so maybe this here is a somewhat better thing to use than even knowing the exact moments of the speciation. I'm not sure that what I said is just coherent, but it's a worry. It's something for closely related species. For distant species, don't worry about it. You know, for divergence between humans and yeast, who cares about our coalescence or the yeast coalescence, because they're both probably pretty. For splits deeper in the tree where they may be close to each other, that can also be, in principle, be a problem. But there, I think it will not mess up too much a contrast analysis for obscure reasons that I won't explain.
In the contrast case over here where we have a clade of really closely diverged species, could we also consider doing something like analyzing them separately and taking the ancestral value or the maximum likelihood estimate of the ancestral value and then just reducing that branch length to the time of the common ancestor of the clade and using that in your overall contrast
analysis? In other words, you would be in effect, if you were doing a contrast analysis, you go down the tree and you get the contrast and you take the means and you get the contrast, take the means and you're... And you end up with a value for this, which is actually you put a little extra branch length on it. Probably you're right that just using that and throwing away the other ones would help get rid of the problem of within species sampling error, because you would then be using it for contrasts that have big denominators anyway. So they're not going to... they're not going to inflate the importance of the sampling error. So yeah, that would be a way to do it. There are ways of, in some programs, my own program contrast in the phylum package, you can get it to print out the multivariate contrasts, and you can figure out which ones are from which comparisons in the tree. And in general, actually, what they would be is the first contrast would be this one, the next would be this one, the third would be that one, the fourth would be this versus that. You can work out which contrasts come out in which order, and then you can throw away the ones that you think are suffering from this problem. That would be another rather simple-minded approach. If you have lots and lots of species, you know, then throwing away some contrast would be probably worth thinking about. If you have only a few species, well, you're in trouble anyway. You don't have very much between species data, and you certainly can't afford to throw any of it away. So, okay, we'll leave it at that. Now, you guys... I believe, are you all assuming that you will turn in your papers electronically, I hope, because I don't want pieces of paper, because then Fred's trying to read them and I'm trying to read them, and we'd be going off to the Xerox room, and I don't want to do that.
.doc.pdf, any preference?
For me, either PDF, probably preferred, or DocX, you know, the recent Microsoft. I can read those, but I can always read PDF, and I think Fred may be in a similar situation. So if he changes his mind and wants only PDF, we'll let you know. So okay, well, thank you for.
You're not very like it's 10 page, but plus minus. Some often with the limits.
Well, we're trying to indicate to you the general size of it. Now, if you want to write 30 pages, go right ahead. but if you want to come,
okay.
if you turn in only 2 pages, we might get cranky.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, okay. If it's got lots of good information. Don't go doing things like double spacing it just so you can get more. You know, just so you can get more pages. That doesn't help.